forgot to mention, remind everybody about our classes. Our kids are heading out and they are starting a new class. It's going to run through the whole year. Angie and Bly are getting that started off. Mike Schreiber is ready to roll for week two with the teens, so hopefully be able to attend that class. And I'll be teaching the adult class in here. We got off to a good start last week talking about belief and talking about that we're eventually going to get into the Apostles' Creed a little bit. So good time for conversation, and I hope that you will be able to spend some time with us. I just checked my phone. I got a note from Deb. Deb got in a little accident on the way here and hit a fire hydrant, apparently. So I'm going to be thinking of Deb this morning and checking up on her. That's all I know. She said wasn't having a good day today. So thinking of her this morning. Kristen, it's good to see you back with us. I know you've been feeling a little better as of late than you were for a while. So good to have you with us. So we kicked off the year's theme last week, looking at the idea of this is us. And one of the reasons I was drawn to this topic this year is our infatuation with biographies and other people. I know a lot of people really enjoy reading biographies. Kurt spent a good time last year reading a biography on Alexander Hamilton, right? You finished that up over the break or something? How many of you enjoy reading biographies? Like most of you, right? Okay, they're so popular that a while back, A&E would run those biography specials, you remember? And they were so popular that they ended up just creating a whole network devoted to sharing biographies. So I thought one of the things that would be interesting is if we spent just a minute this morning with sharing some of the more interesting biographies that you have read, some of the more interesting people. So if anybody has any that they would like to share this morning, go ahead and share. Good biographies that you've read recently. Or those of you who don't read, maybe watched a biography. What's that? No, just one that makes it, you know, the one that made it an imprint that you still remember. The best, Clara Barton, all right? All these years later, that's the one that you... Pat? Helen Keller. You have the same one. See, I mean, it's interesting, right? Some people's story is just so compelling that you're like, I want to know more about that. Somebody over there has, Greg? In football, basketball? Oh, any sport at all. What did he play? Okay. You know, one of the things I think is especially interesting about biographies is how many times have you read a biography about somebody like that who not everybody knows who it is, but their story or something they've done is so interesting or so peculiar that it just kind of draws a lot of attention. And so that's a great example. Other people read biographies? Ron? Martin Luther King? Lots of opportunities to learn about him. Kristen? Yeah. Everybody's got their own interest. Some people, like, you go to the sports section of a bookstore, tons of biographies because people want to read about their favorite athletes or politics or just scientists. I got a huge biography on Einstein in my office that I hope to read here someday soon. Hopefully that'll rub off a little bit more. Anybody else? Biographies? Cameron? Babe Ruth. A guy like Babe, what an interesting guy. Like, I'm convinced that you could write a biography about anybody, it would be interesting. Like, if you really highlight the interesting parts of people's lives, I mean, really, all of us live a pretty interesting life. I mean, how many times have you sitting down or standing up at a dinner party or something, and you're talking to somebody, and at just a couple moments in, you're like, this person is really, this is a really interesting person. There's a lot of interesting things about them. I haven't read a biography in a while, but I did read, when I was doing my sports research, there's a book that Brian Kilmeade is a collection of kind of many biographies, and it's stories from famous people, famous in politics, celebrities, musicians, just all over the board. And it's their story of sports when they were kids. And there's a couple things that were interesting. Two of them I'll share with you that I think are really interesting. Is one of them, and I found this anecdote a couple times, is that one time when Bill Clinton was a kid, like a teenager, he played church league basketball. And even after he was president and served 8 years as president and everything he went through, he could still remember the time that he was the leading scorer in a game in a church league basketball game. And you're like, well, that probably says something about Bill Clinton. Well, the same story is of George W. Bush. He counted among the most famous, you know, people ask him, who was your favorite person you met in the White House? Guess who he said? Ted Williams, his childhood kind of icon. But it's just interesting to kind of hear the behind-the-scenes stories of people, because there's this kind of myth that envelops people as they become successful or famous or whatever, and they kind of become like larger than life. And I think what biographies do is they kind of bring them back to life, and you realize, oh, it's just kind of an ordinary person. Maybe not so ordinary, but at least relatable. So today I wanted to talk about the subject, and I don't know that there's a specific person that fits this category of a biography maybe that you've read, but I wanted you to think, one of my favorite words is the word eccentric. I love that word because you never know if it's an insult or a compliment. Like if somebody says, oh, they're being eccentric, like I kind of like, oh, that's cool. But then you start to wonder, well, maybe they were meaning something not so nice. Like, I kind of wonder, like, do I want to be eccentric? Like, is that something you want to strive for? And then I wonder, well, is it really something that you can strive for? Are you really born eccentric? Or if you're trying to be eccentric, you're not really eccentric. It's really kind of a fancy, highfalutin word, right? Like, it's half highbrow and half mysterious. Because when someone says that you're an eccentric or you are eccentric, you're like, oh, thanks. Wait a second. Because it's really just a fancy word for weird, right? Like, that's really all that it is instead of somebody saying you're weird, oh, they're just kind of eccentric. And so I started wondering if I was eccentric. I kind of want to be eccentric sometimes. But then I think maybe because I want to be eccentric, I'm not eccentric. And so when I was thinking about this week, and I was doing a little research, I found this movie that a director had made, and it debuted in Canada about a year ago by a guy named John Zaritsky, whoever that guy is. And he has this movie entitled A Different Drummer, Celebrating Eccentrics. And what he did was he followed around like 7 or 8 people who were just weird. Like just odd people. And when I read through the description of these people, I couldn't find the movie because I was like, I need to watch this movie. This sounds really cool. I couldn't find it. So I just, when I read the descriptions of the eccentrics, I thought, nah, I'm not eccentric. I'm not that weird. So here's a couple of the people that they followed around for a while. One of the guys' name is Daniel Suelo. And he was walking down the highway in Utah several years ago. And he has this like epiphany. And he decides that he's going to take all of his material possessions and leave them in a payphone booth on the side of the road and give up his relationship with money forever. And so now he lives in a cave out in Utah, and he scours for roadkill and expired groceries in trash cans. He has a job, like he works, but he doesn't take money for it. He just wants food for it. And he's weird, but I guess it's more polite to call him eccentric. Then there's a guy named Gary Holloway, happened to be one of our professors in college, not the same guy. He walks around in monk's clothes, even though he's not a monk. He just really likes Francis of Assisi. And so he walks around in the whole abbot gear and all this stuff. And he started, for some reason only known to him because he's weird, he felt like Martin Van Buren was like a really neglected president because he was such a terrible president. So he decided that there needed to be a Van Buren fan club. And so he started a Van Buren fan club, which meets every year. If you would like more information, you can check the movie out. Oh, and then by the way, and then they just kind of throw this thing in there. Oh, and by the way, all the stuff that he had in his childhood room is still in his room now, and he's like 60. Just weird stuff. Laura K. Prophet lives in this humble tenant in Vancouver with her duck. And the duck she puts in a buggy, like this cart that she pushes around, and the duck has a cookie in its mouth, and they pull up and they let people have the cookie in their in the duck's mouth. And inside the cookie is money. And it could be anywhere from $100 to $1. And she's given away $20,000 this way just to be nice, just to be so weird, right? It's so weird. And then finally, this one might take the cake. She is a professor in Bridgefield, Connecticut. Her name is Darla Shaw. And she has a portable shower that doubles as a phone booth. And she never throws anything away, like nothing. And so you can imagine how quickly things begin to pile up. And so she had to buy an abandoned opera house in Connecticut so apparently she's wealthy too, so that she could keep all of her wares that she doesn't want to throw away. She pushes a shopping cart with a headlight between her classes, and she had a papier-mâché mermaid that died. And then she took the mermaid out and gave it an official Viking funeral on the water with burning torches in the whole thing. And so I realized, okay, maybe I'm not that eccentric. Maybe I'm not that weird. But that's what makes eccentric people eccentric, right? They just do their own thing. And the reason that the director set out to study eccentrics is because psychologists have determined that true eccentrics are pretty optimistic. I mean, they don't care what you think about them. I mean, otherwise they would never live the way that they do. They don't care. They're pretty happy, pretty content with their lives. They live the way that they do. And so the director thought, well, I'm gonna study some of these especially odd people. And he found that was, for the most part, the case. What's interesting is that eccentric people even show up in the Bible. Like, I don't think that the eccentrics among us are the majority, obviously. You can look around here and decide who the eccentrics are. I don't know if we have any true eccentrics here this morning. But if you are, or if you have one in your family, we probably all have Cousin Larry or something that, you know, everybody talks about. But even the eccentrics show up in the Bible. So when I think of eccentrics in the Bible, I think of Ezekiel pretty quickly. Like, that guy is super weird. And we don't have time to get into all the stuff that Ezekiel did, but he kind of plays with poop and just odd things, right? Like, that's in the Bible. You can go back and read it at the beginning of Ezekiel. That's kind of what he does. As a matter of fact, most of the prophets are eccentrics. I mean, they do odd things, very strange things. You think of Elijah. He was probably a pretty odd guy, pretty interesting. And of course, we're building up to probably the most known strange person in the Bible, who was John the Baptist, right? That's where we're going today. We took a long while to get there, but we finally get to the true eccentric among us, John the Baptist. Just a strange, strange guy. Let's remind ourselves of the beginning of his story. In the beginning of Luke, it's interesting, one of the reasons I want to do this early in the year is because it comes right on the cusp of Christmas, and we spend all the time with the birth story of Jesus. And sometimes we kind of neglect the fact that John the Baptist's story kind of runs parallel to Jesus' story, especially in the Gospel of Luke. So in Luke chapter 1, beginning in verse 5, when Herod was king of Judea, there was a Jewish priest named Zechariah. He was a member of the priestly order of Abijah, and his wife Elizabeth was also from the priestly line of Aaron. Zechariah and Elizabeth were righteous in God's eyes, careful to obey all the Lord's commands and regulations. They didn't have any kids because Elizabeth was unable to conceive, and they were both very old. We've heard that story before, haven't we, in the Bible? It happens over and over again. Well, then one day, Zechariah was serving God in the temple, for his order was on duty that week, and as was custom of the priest, he was chosen by lot to enter the sanctuary of the Lord and burn incense. While the incense was being burned, a great crowd stood outside praying. When Zechariah was in the sanctuary, an angel of the Lord appeared to him, standing to the right of the incense altar. Zechariah was shaken and overwhelmed with fear when he saw him. Again, a theme that comes up often when you see angels, you don't want to put them on the sticker on your window. You're scared to death because they're kind of fearsome. But the angel said, "Don't be afraid, Zechariah. God has heard your prayer. Your wife Elizabeth will give you a son, and you're to give him the name John. You will have great joy and gladness, and many will rejoice at his birth, for he will be great in the eyes of the Lord. He must never touch wine or alcoholic drinks. He will be filled with the Holy Spirit even before his birth. And he will turn many Israelites to the Lord their God. He will be a man with the spirit and power of Elijah." So he beckons the spirit of another eccentric. He's going to be kind of like Elijah. And he will prepare the people for the coming of the Lord. He will turn the hearts of the fathers to their children, and it will cause those who are rebellious to accept the wisdom of the godly. So it's not quite the announcement that Mary and Joseph received, but it's pretty close. Angel comes. Mary and Joseph are kind of at the other end of life. They're young, not really expecting children quite yet. Zechariah and Elizabeth, that has already passed. And they get this announcement kind of out of the blue, maybe from the blue, but God has heard their prayers. And the promise is different, of course. Joseph and Mary are to bring the Messiah who is going to save Israel. John is kind of the opening act. It's not all about John, but John's got a big role. John is preparing the way. There's a lot of theatrics associated with John's birth that you can read as you go on. His father is struck and not able to talk because of his doubt. And so he exits the temple area and he tries to explain to people what's happened, you know, using gestures and all this, and they kind of figure out, oh, he's had some kind of vision, and he's not able to talk, assuming that he probably is never going to talk again. If you know the story well, you know that he finally is able to talk, but not until his wife has the child, so 8, 9, 10 months later, he's finally able to speak. And you remember, he's able to speak when they want to choose the name of the child, because the custom was you would choose the name from the father's family. But Elizabeth says, no, we're going to name him John. That's what the angel told us. And they're astonished because this doesn't fit into the system very well. And finally, Zechariah surprises everybody after not speaking for almost a year and says, no, his name is John. John was special. He was different. He was the weird kid. We don't know that, but you kind of figure out that he was eventually the weird guy, because he moves out into the desert and he began preaching and ministering there. Luke says in Luke 3:3 that he preached a baptism of repentance for the forgiveness of sins. Prepare for the way of the Lord. He fulfills the prophet Isaiah's prophecy that he will be a voice crying in the desert, prepare the way of the Lord, make straight paths for him in Isaiah 40. John's ministry brings up the conversation of prophets. Historically, there were three kind of roles of Old Testament leaders. You had prophets, you had priests, and you had kings. The priests were the ones that kind of maintained things, kept things rolling the way that they were. The priestly family, Zechariah and Elizabeth, were from priestly families. They went and got things ready at the temple. They helped the sacrificial system. We know how they were supposed to sacrifice and why they were supposed to sacrifice, and what we have to not forget is that there were a lot of jobs that had to do with the temple. If you're sacrificing all these animals, somebody's got to clean up. Somebody's got to take out the body parts. Somebody's got to deal with the ashes. All that kind of stuff was part of the priestly role. The kings, of course, maintained kind of the governorship, the leaders of the bunch. And then there were these prophets. And the prophets kind of existed on the outer boundaries of the camp. They were the ones that shook things up when it needed shaken up. That's one of the reasons they were eccentric. They tended to be the weird people who'd come in from the outside edges of camp saying, hey, you all need to turn your lives around. Hey, you've all allowed yourselves to get pretty far away. It's interesting that priests never do that. Priests are more times the problem than the solution. It's prophets that kind of live in this kind of tenuous way. And John proves to be an important prophet, a unique prophet. He fits a role that no one else fits, because he becomes kind of the hinge between the Old Testament and the New Testament, the Old Covenant and the New Covenant. He begins to pave the way for Jesus, and we're not surprised to find out that it's disruptive. The role of the prophet is often disruptive. Luke chapter 3, beginning in verse 7. When the crowds came to John for baptism, he said, "You brood of snakes!" Like, imagine this, you're leaving life as you know it in the city. Maybe you're moonlighting in the evening to go hear this eccentric prophet on the edge of town, and he calls you a bunch of snakes. "Who warned you to flee the coming wrath? Prove by the way you live that you've repented of your sins and turned to God. Don't just say to each other, 'We're safe because we're descendants of Abraham.' That means nothing. For I tell you, God can create children of Abraham from these very stones. Even now, the axe of God's judgment is poised, ready to sever the roots of the trees. Yes, every tree that does not produce good fruit will be chopped down and thrown into the fire." The crowds ask, "Well, what should we do, John?" John replied, "Well, if you have two shirts, give one to the poor. If you have food, share with those who are hungry." Even corrupt tax collectors came to be baptized and asked, "Teacher, what should we do?" He said, "Don't collect any more taxes than the government requires." "What should we do?" asked some of the soldiers. And John replied, "Don't extort money and make false accusations. Be content with the pay that you receive." And listen to this. Everyone was expecting the Messiah to come soon, and they were eager to know whether John might be the Messiah. So just like his birth story is similar, but not quite the level of Jesus's, the buzz around John begins to come, like it will later of Jesus. Questions begin to be asked. Hey, we're supposed to be waiting for somebody who's a big deal here, right? Maybe he's the one. But John answered the questions by saying, "I baptize you with water, but someone who's coming after me is greater than I am. So much greater that I'm not even worthy to be a slave and untie the straps of his sandals. He will baptize you with the Holy Spirit and with fire. He's ready to separate the chaff from the wheat with his winnowing fork. Then he will clean up the threshing area, gathering the wheat into his barn, but burning the chaff with never-ending fire." John used many such warnings as he announced the good news to the people. John also publicly criticized Herod Antipas, the ruler of Galilee, for marrying Herodias, his brother's wife, and for many other wrongs he had done. So Herod put John in prison, adding this sin to many others. After reading the contents, the notions of his teaching, we're not surprised to learn the fact that John ends up in prison, are we? He disrupts the status quo. He comes in and he shakes things up and he says things that people don't want to hear. Priests didn't often really do that. They were more ministering within the status quo of the situation. The prophets were the ones that shook the cart. They were the ones that made everybody upset. They were the ones that were trying to get people to see things that they hadn't seen before. Prophets often end up in jail, outcast, ignored, or made fun of. John came along at a time when things were just rolling along like they always did. The institutions within the Jewish religion had become comfortable, static. Everybody was comfortable. And the message that I think we need to hear, and I wrestled for a long time this week, of what is the message for us in John the Baptist? He serves this kind of unique role between the transition between the old and the new laws, stuff that we've been kind of born and raised on and we've heard our whole lives. But what about his message resonates with us? And I think it's this. I think it's the fact that he comes into a pretty comfortable setting. Because I think being comfortable might be one of the biggest threats to our faith. Being comfortable is our biggest problem, especially in this country. Many people were attracted to the teachings of John because eccentrics tend to draw a crowd. It's kind of like a zoo. Like, oh, look at the weird guy. Look at the strange thing. Wow. But the teachings I just read sound an awful lot like the teachings that Jesus would then lead. A lot of people think Jesus was actually a disciple of John, starting off, right? He eventually baptizes him. What's interesting is that John is always able, even though he gets all that attention, even though people begin to ask the question, maybe he's the one, he's always able to divert that attention and say, no, not about me. It's about the one who's coming after me. The life of a prophet is difficult. John ends up in prison. He denounces the practices of the leaders. And as important as John is to the story of Jesus, we don't really know much about him. Other than that initial A, preparing the way of Jesus, he ends up in prison. What's really interesting is John, as he's sitting around in prison, starts to apparently question about Jesus' role. Luke chapter 7, after some time passes, beginning in verse 18, the disciples of John the Baptist told John everything Jesus was doing. He's kind of removed now because he's in prison. So John called for two of his disciples and he sent them to the Lord and asked him, "Are you the Messiah we've been expecting, or should we look for somebody else?" John's two disciples found Jesus and said to him, "John the Baptist sent us to ask, are you the Messiah we've been expecting, or is somebody else, should we be looking for somebody else?" At that very time, Jesus cured many people of their diseases, illnesses, and evil spirits. He restored sight to many who were blind. And then Jesus told John's disciples, "Go back to John and tell him what you've seen and heard. The blind see, the lame walk, those with leprosy are cured, the deaf hear, the dead are raised to life, and the good news is being preached to the poor." And then he added, "God blesses those who do not fall away because of me." Ironically, as John had been calling the people away from their comfort, here we have an insight into a time where John is uncomfortable. The guy who was calling them to be uncomfortable, he becomes uncomfortable because he starts to question and wonder, "Are you the right guy? Are you the one we've been waiting for?" There's a message here that cautions us against being comfortable with our faith. We have to constantly battle our own tendencies towards complacency and apathy and being comfortable. I mean, think about the trajectory of the history of Israel to this time. They were God's chosen people. They were waiting on a Messiah. And they were just going about their business like they always had. And John comes along and he shakes the system up and he says, "This is not the way it's supposed to be. You guys don't have this figured out yet." I've said this many times, every day can't be Christmas Day, which is just another way of saying most of life is pretty boring. It's interesting when you read a biography, a lot of the biography is boring stuff. It's interesting because it's unique and it kind of contributes to the larger narrative of the person, but by and large, they were born to parents, they went to school, they went to college, whatever it is, just like most every other person. And then they have a couple divergences here and there, but most of life is pretty boring. Most of life is just getting up and doing your deal. What John the Baptist does is he tries to rattle our cages and remind us that in the midst of your everyday life, do not grow complacent. Do not grow comfortable. Shake things up. Do things differently. I was thinking about that yesterday. I took Cecilia sledding, one of the neighbor girls. We went over to Sharon Woods and we're out and, you know, enjoying the sledding hill at Sharon Woods. And I thought, you know, isn't it interesting? And everybody's laughing. I mean, except for this one kid that got drilled. Like, there's always like the two-year-old who hasn't learned to get out of the way. And so he's like closer to the one side and he starts walking that way. And for some reason, he turns around and starts walking right in the middle. And the dad that was right beside me just sent a kid down and he smoked him. And of course, everybody's all worried. And I'm like, "Get him out of the way. Like, you know, and is he bleeding? He's fine." But, you know, there was all the trauma and everything else. Except for that one moment, everybody's laughing and smiling and having a great time, even though that the news had been predicting this Armageddon for 2 days, 3 days, you know, and everybody's worried. But it was taking everybody out of their comfort zone, out of their routine, to remind them. I mean, there was this one big dude, and he was FaceTiming or Facebook Live-ing somebody from some other place. I don't know where it was. And he's smiling and said, "Yeah." And he's like, I don't know, he's probably my age. He's like, "Ah, I'm going to go sledding." He's like, "No, I wouldn't be the only adult." And I think he looked over at me because I've been sledding too. But there's just something about just getting out of your comfort zone, getting out of your routines, making lemonade out of lemons, if you will. You're just doing something that's different. Because when you wake up every day and you begin to feel this is the complacency. This is the way it's always been. This is how we've always done things. You know, being part of a small church, I think, lends it to that sometimes. You look around and you're sitting in the same seat that you sit in every week, and a month has gone by, and the next thing you know, 2 years have gone by, or 3 years have gone by, and it just feels so like it always has. The challenge before us, without a true eccentric to kind of stand up and take us to task this morning, is the challenge we all face of how do I keep my faith fresh, new and alive, and not allow myself to get down this pathway where I just don't really care that much anymore. I mean, yeah, I'll say that I do, but it's difficult because most of life is just pretty boring. Most of the Bible is kind of boring. It's just kind of living life, and then these moments come along. Jesus comes along and says, it's boring, but it's meaningful, and it's valuable, and it's incredible. Like, let's not manufacture that every day is Christmas Day. It's not. But in the end, it will be. I don't know if this resonates with you this morning. I struggle a little bit with finding the message from John, but I think there's a lot of meaning and truth into this idea. That we have to look ourselves in the mirror, especially as I get older. The days pass more quickly, and all of a sudden, no, that was a couple months ago. No, that was 5 years ago. No, that was 10 years ago. My parents were the first people that I recognized doing this. No, that was just a few years ago. No, it was 15 years ago, Mom. Well, the thing is, when that happens, it begins to flatten our experiences. So, still January, we're still kind of heading out in the new year. Find ways to breathe life into your faith this year. Find ways to make every day exciting. You gotta wear, go eat locusts, and go eat locusts, whatever you need to do. Find a way to just breathe life and meaning into every day, not just in your own life and faith, but into our church. How can I do something new and different here today? That's what John's legacy kind of calls us to. We're gonna stand and sing this final song this morning before we head out. It's a perfect song to get you thinking about what God is doing in your life today. If you will stand up with us, and we'll sing on the way out.
These are the days of the